Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
On today's show, we're going to talk about how to be a better patient.
And we have a guest, Aaron LePage, to tell us the ins and outs of nursing.
And we're going to answer a couple of voicemails, including why we chose to be gastroenterologists. Stick around. It's going to be a great show.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Hey, welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
And let me start off again by asking how we're doing.
Usually Lizzie answers first, so I'll go ahead and go ahead.
I'm doing well.
Wait. You just said...
How are you doing, Joe? Lizzie, my answer to that question is Lizzie answers first.
That's right.
So you're feeling insecure.
I'm just trying to think of something to answer, so I like you going first, so I have like 10 seconds to think of
something. I agree. I wanted you to go first this
time. You wanted Joe to go to first?
I wanted to go.
Oh, man. This show's getting weird.
We're totally early. Going off the rails. Yeah. So it's been a nice, relaxing weekend, good weather, all that good stuff. So, you know, life is good. Joe, did you go fishing?
30 seconds.
Did you go fishing? Did you take all your Mondays off?
Actually, good question. I went fishing a couple times, and the last five times I've gone out fishing, I haven't even gotten a bite. The only thing I've caught is a buzz. That's it. But you know what? I have a great time just being out there. It's so fun. And then catching fish is the bonus. But yeah, I'm horrible losing streak in that way.
Aw.
Yeah.
Well, I'll bring it back to medicine then, and we could talk about... I think we should do a segment on how to be a better patient. People can call in and email us and tell us how we could be better doctors or better podcasters, better HOPers, if you will.
They do.
Hoppers. People should do that more. And then we can tell the world how to be a better patient. that's not condescending at
no,
all.
No, I think that's fair.
That's
I think,
normal.
I actually believe that question should come up. I know the patient's technically the customer or whatever, but there are ways that patients could be better to actually help themselves.
Right.
For anything else.
It is a two-way street. We want to help doctors be better doctors, but we want to help patients be better patients and get more out of their experience with their doctor.
Yeah. It's just the problem, I think, with any relationship in the world is just expectations, you know, and some people have really high expectations. Some people have really low expectations, you know. I'll email one person, hey, your colonoscopy was fine. They write me back, thank you so much. And the next person's like, I want this, that, this. I want the report. I want this. You know, can you tell me more? Can you call me? And it's just, it's very interesting. It's really a personality-driven, expectation-driven conversation. So what I got was an email the other day from a patient. And it just, honestly, I don't even remember the exact details, which is good because I don't want to violate anyone's privacy. But it essentially said, hey, Dr. Ross, I'm not feeling great. Should I continue on the medication you gave me twice a day? So I immediately read this and, you know, and it's fine.
Wait. First, yeah. Before you answer that, Joe, just from hearing that, what would you think might be an issue for Lizzie? Just
well, yeah,
from
she's that? Saying I prescribed the medication for a reason. So why are you asking that? But on the patient's part, if the patient's not feeling well or getting bad side effects, then that's a totally fair question.
No. The patient should always be able to ask questions about their medication, what they're taking. I don't think that's what Lizzie's getting to.
The email and the concept of the email, I have no problems with. And I'll just, let's just not let Joe struggle with this. Can I just get to the punch?
My frustration is
that I immediately now, I don't know what medicine, I don't know what I said about the dosing before and what our plan was, and it's fine. I can easily go back, click on the patient's chart, open it up, click, you know, Lizzie's notes, And it just takes another 2 or 3 minutes, and that is fine. And this is my job. But I just think that it would help me a little bit if they said, you know how we discussed this medicine instead of that medicine and taking it twice a day instead of once a day? Well, I've been doing that for 2 weeks, and I have no change. What's your next piece of advice? Because I get tens of emails a day, and I cannot remember. And I see tens of patients a day. I cannot remember which medicine.
Wait, are you saying tons with a weird accent? Or are you saying tens, like the number tens?
I'm not Canadian. This is about just ten, like dozens, I should have said. But then I don't want to exaggerate, so I said tens. You know, you're just, thank you, Kavi.
I got to jump on this real quick. So this is how I would view it. And I'm biased because I'm the patient.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do try to myself over-communicate in the beginning to give them some sort of frame of reference. But the bottom line is that it's the doctor's job to know who you're seeing before you see them. There has to be a little bit of preparation, at least some basic preparation. If they have questions, they can ask the patient. But they should come prepared, I feel.
This is, so I've seen the patient. We come up with a plan. And then they're emailing me 2-4 weeks later. And I'm just saying that we came up with a plan. We discussed it. And I can't remember if you say, hey, doc, I'm on this pill once a day. Do you think I should go up twice a day without telling me the dose or the name of the medicine? I can't remember you, Joe, which pill we discussed.
But don't you have access to the file that you could just take a quick look? Or
we do. I just have to start from scratch. I just have to go back and look at what I ordered and look at what my plan was. And that is totally okay. I'm just saying it would help me a little bit to know when I open the chart, which medicine, like, what am I, what,
so,
what's the approach?
Yeah, you're human. You can't remember everything.
What I think it comes down to, the bottom line is, and I think patients, I totally understand where they're coming from, because to them, this is the most important thing, understandably, and it should be. Their health should be the most important thing. They have to remember that we don't remember every detail of what's going on with them. We have to offer, that's why we keep good records, so we can look back and say, okay, this person was being seen for this, and this is what I started them on, this is my thought process. So it helps us just to have a frame of reference, just like you said, and it's good for them to keep it in mind that we don't remember every detail. And that's actually okay. You don't want a doctor's brain to be filled with every inane detail about your whole medication list. That's why we keep good records, so we can go to them and we can use them, you know?
Yeah.
So I think
that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, patients should have some sort of expectation to give the doctor at least some information so that they're not having to check every single record and whatnot. That's fair.
And there are definitely some folks, some patients who are not as medically savvy, just didn't grow up with it, didn't learn about it, and that is okay. I do not judge that. And then a tiny frustration, which you can usually overcome pretty easily, or you just give up, is, sir, what medicine are you on? And they don't know. And then I'll say, oh, well, I have a list here. Can I read them off to you? And I'll say, are you on lisinopril? Are you on Zocor? And they'll say, I don't know. Then I often will say, you should just have a list on you. You know, they just can't remember. Because again, there's a medical literacy, and it's just everyone has a different level of education on that stuff.
I mean, it's good points. I think the patients should either have homework, or patients probably don't know these things benefit doctors as much as they do. And maybe it's as simple as a 5-question form that you fill out before you go into to see the doctor, so there's some information. I don't know what the solution is, but I think patients just don't realize where you guys are coming from and may not know to, hey, maybe write down all the medications you're on before you go in the office.
Right.
Because they're going to ask that every time.
I mean, this is an ongoing problem in every medical office everywhere. Is what's the best way to keep good records, and what's the best way for the patient to keep track of what they're taking? I think in general with electronic medical records, we're hopefully getting better at this sort of thing. But yeah, just like Lizzie said, it's hard. Sometimes people don't really know, have a good grasp of what they're taking. That certainly becomes tricky.
Or maybe they think I'm going to go see the GI doc for my stomach issues, so who cares about my cholesterol, blood pressure medicine kind of stuff, when our job is to review every medication you're
good
taking.
Point.
So.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough.
So that was how to be a better patient. We could think of more things.
Is that a first installment? If this is too condescending and people hate it too much, we'll drop it. But who knows? People may like it.
It's a great point you never hear from a patient's point of view. And it makes total sense. And I think it's just a matter of somehow letting the patient know, or expecting the patient to come with some information prior.
Yeah,
and that would solve a lot of the problems, at least.
It helps when there's contribution from both parties.
So if you have any other ideas for us to talk about in regards to this sort of thing, how to be a better patient, how to be a better doctor, let us know. Send us an email, hopquestions@gmail.com, or call us and leave a voicemail, 408-444-6623. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. We're going to take a phone call. This is from Jennifer. Listen up.
Hi, this is Jennifer, and I have a question for Kaveh and Lizzie. I was just curious as to why you went into GI as opposed to other areas of specialty. Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Jennifer. So she's asking why we went into GI, which is gastroenterology. Sorry, Joe, the question's not for you. So I guess I'll answer first. You know, you do 4 years of med school, 3 years of, for Kaveh and I, we did internal medicine. After med school, you can choose. Do you want to do surgery? Do you want to do psych? Do you want to do OB-GYN? Do you want to do peds? Do you want to do medicine? We both chose medicine. And some people know very early on sort of their path, what they want. For me, I decided a year or two into medicine training that the people that I met who did GI were grounded, smart, normal-ish. You know, again, like we talked about, the bubble of medicine.
What the hell happened to you two then?
Right. Oh, face.
Right. So the concept of like Dr. Cool, Dr. Hot, Dr. Normal, let's say, is a unique term for the world that we live in. And I found that the people in GI were, again, smart, funny, and for me also mixed up this life of procedures and office and hospital work. So it wasn't all one thing. I love the ICU. I liked medicine clinic, but there's such, I think, burnout. And that's something I think we'll talk about on future shows is physician wellness and physician burnout. And if you break it up with a procedure or office or hospital consults, I think that it really promotes longevity in a career. And that's what I liked about GI.
Totally makes sense. But what is the appeal to, how do I put this?
Poop.
Being an ass doctor, essentially. Why would anyone want to be an ass doctor?
So
I'll let Kaveh take this one.
So we get this a lot. This is a question, and I get it. There are certain like specialties that sound much sexier. You could be like, I'm a pediatric cardiologist, I'm a pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon. And that sounds really great.
Gynecologist.
There are like fields of medicine that certainly have more curb appeal to them. But there aren't many that give you a good mix of things. In particular for me, there's not a lot of things you can do that give you both the procedural component. You get to work with your hands. You get to do something that, you know, you feel physically like challenged. That's a good thing to have in your life. And then also gives you that cerebral component where you have to think about things and you think things through, and there's diseases that you have to learn a lot about, and you can really dive into the pathology behind those. So there's not, in my mind, there wasn't a lot of things that gave me a good mix of both that were entertaining in that way. And I'm sure there's specialists out there who are going to call and tell us that we're idiots for this, but I didn't find anything that called to me in that same way.
Okay.
I think also with GI, you know, you think of poop and you think of butt, you know, but it's really, it's one of the ones that are the most, one of the fields, I think that's one of the most diverse. Yeah. It's pancreas, gallbladder, liver, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis,
I didn't know all that stuff, you
colon,
guys.
Stomach, esophagus, heartburn, you know, there's really, I mean, I'm sure every field has
You heard of colon cancer?
No, I never heard of it. I think my grandmother died of it or something. I don't know.
Oh, that's not funny.
It's not
funny. He's laughing because it's not funny. Anyway, there's a huge diversity. And again, if you talk to a cardiologist, they'll say heart failure and embryologic. I mean, there's a wide variety in every field if you really get into any one field. But again, you hear GI and most people are like, ugh, poop, you know, and stomach, vomit, whatever, ulcers. But there really is so much. Yeah. And one thing that's good about being a general GI is that you really, hopefully, and we do Hep C, Hep B, you really can get your fingers in, you know, in everything.
A lot of different things. That's cool.
Yeah, I know. It's too easy. There's too many openings for that. You get your fingers in things. Yeah.
Double entendre.
Yeah. So, and you know, and it's a fun job. I mean, we essentially get to play video games, like in the human body in a way, you know, you have like this procedural component where you get to like go and do, you get cool toys and you get gadgets and you get to feel like you actually did something. If you take out a big polyp, if you stop someone from bleeding, you feel like you accomplished something. And that's good, because a lot of the day in, day out of medicine is mind-numbing computer charting work. And a lot of times you can go through a day without feeling like you've accomplished something. This is a bigger subject for them, I think we're going to really approach today, but there's a lot of days go by where you don't feel like you really accomplish much. And if you are able to go in there and procedurally do something, that feels good. It's a very concrete thing that you can walk away from.
It is good. The scope takes you away from the computer. So you don't even, I honestly don't appreciate that on a daily basis, but it is, you know, it takes you away from your phone, takes you away from the computer.
No, totally makes sense. So you did mention at the beginning, Lizzie, that when I decided to go into medicine, you said, does medicine mean GI? I didn't understand what you meant.
That was something actually that was very sort of surprising to me. When you start medical school, you hear about people going into medicine, and that is actually just adult medicine, internal medicine. But people say go into medicine.
I think all medicine is medicine.
Right. When I was a first or second year med student, I remember people saying that, and I had never heard people talk like that. But that just means adult internal medicine, as opposed to pediatrics, as opposed to surgery, psych, OB-GYN. You're choosing adult medicine. So it's interesting.
So the others are non-medicine?
Well, right. That's why it's sort of a weird thing, but that's how we talk. That's jargon.
There's big groups. You go into internal medicine, you say, I'm going into medicine. But if you want to be specific, you say, I'm going into internal medicine. If you're going into surgery, you say, I'm going into surgery. Are you going into pediatrics?
There are types of medicine, but for some reason, when you just say general, it's a weird jargon. I have to say, as we are sedating people for colonoscopy and upper endoscopy,
super common question.
The most common thing that I'm asked, and I want to, you know, we could ask Joe what you would think, but the most common thing that I'm asked is, why did you choose GI? And the other question is, how many of these do you do a day? You would think that as you're getting sort of druggy and loopy, people would ask like more crazy questions.
Yeah.
But it's usually, why did you go into GI,
right.
and how many of these do you do a day?
Why are they waiting right at that minute, I wonder? Because it's okay to...
They'll ask like when they're in the room. I mean, that doesn't necessarily always mean like as they're getting sedated, but that's certainly a very common question we get from patients. They're obviously a little nervous before their procedure and they want to talk. Sometimes they're just really curious. Sometimes they want to break the ice and... they will ask that. Do you know what I like to say when they ask me how many of these I've done?
Tell me.
I like this. Here, let's practice. Joe, you be a patient.
So, Dr. Cave, how many of these have you actually done?
This will be my first one. But I watched it on YouTube, and it looked really easy.
Right.
Good enough for me.
Exactly. What I say, because again, being a young woman, I try not to make those kind of jokes because people don't like that. Although it is actually very funny. I'll say...
They usually laugh.
No, it's obviously it's not your first one, but that would be really funny if they looked at you like sort of terrified. What? Anyway, I usually say, honestly, you stop counting after a couple thousand. Because it's true. We both have done probably over 5,000 at this point.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But you do. And when you're training, you count how many you have to count because you have to show the, supervising boards that you have done, I think, 200 colonoscopies in your training. And honestly, we've all probably done more, but you have a minimum. So you do stop counting at some point. I mean, we all do. But I say you stop counting after 2,000. And I think that's a reassuring thing.
Totally. Yeah, obviously. Is there a bad thing asking a doctor about that? Yeah, how many procedures?
No, I'll tell you this. It's not bad. And we totally are used to these questions. And I think that we're fine with them. I'm totally fine with them. But when they do ask, like, why did you choose to go into GI? There is a little bit of this weird, like, why would you do such a weird job? There's a little bit of that.
A little judgment. But it's also like sort of a let's sit down and have a beer conversation, like we're doing right now, minus the beer. But you're about to do a procedure. It's not necessarily the life, philosophical, existential question that you want to answer in that
time
moment.
And place.
So I do answer very quickly. I'm like, oh, no, there's a lot of mixtures, procedures in office, whatever. I give them a really quick version. But it is sort of a judgmental, like, why do you like poop so much again? And by the way, usually the colonoscopies that we do, the patients are prepped. They're like,
We deal with much less poop than people think we do, you know? I'm sure poor ER doctors deal with much more poop than we do.
Really?
Oh, yeah, man. People come in, they're really sick. A lot of people from the street covered in poop, or they're demented and they're pooping, or they're incontinent. I mean,
I don't like
there's a lot of poop in medicine.
There's a lot of poop. And unfortunately, GI probably has the least amount. Woohoo! I don't actually, this happened to me last week. A patient he wasn't even going to sleep yet. I didn't give him any sedation. He was wide awake and he asked me how old I was. And I didn't really like that. I don't know.
That's different. That's a little different.
It's different. It's funny. I'll tell you this, because it's actually funny, because for you, it's a totally different thing than when they ask me that. Like I will occasionally still get people being like, how many have you done? Because they're surprised that I've done so many because they think I'm young.
Right.
And when that happens, I actually like it because I'm like, oh, wow, great. You think I'm like young and like that's great. But for you, I know it's a little different.
Right.
Because you are a young looking woman doctor. You have to sort of come in there and set the stage. I think we've talked about this before, right? It's like the first day you get to prison, you have to like go smash a chair over the biggest guy's head to show them that you are not to be fucked with.
Right.
It's the same sort of concept. You have to like prove your like dominance as a doc, that you are to be taken seriously.
Right. But, and then he went on to say, he did ask me, I did answer, cause I think not answering makes it more awkward. And he's like, yeah, but you don't look a day over 25. I'm like, I said, next time, just say that second part. But I don't. Right. And don't ask me how old I am. Yeah.
They come off offensive, and it's not relevant age. What they really want to know is, are you qualified?
I think he was trying to compliment me, and maybe it was a little flirty. That's why I didn't like it, because it's none of his business. Mm-hmm. I do think what you were asking. I think asking how many you've done is a totally legitimate, appropriate, and good question, because you shouldn't go to a surgeon or a proceduralist or even a doctor who hasn't seen enough, you know?
What does the surgeon or any doctor do in that situation if they are new and someone asks them that and they've never done...
Well, I mean, part of the beauty of it is that when you do these specialty things is that... No, you should never lie about that. But what you should do is you should tell the truth, which is that you've done a lot of training to get to that point. So even if you were, say, fresh out of fellowship, the way you tell the patient is, well, I did, you know, X years of residency to learn about the human body and about health. I did maybe if you did a year of chief like Lizzie and I did, you tell them that. You say, I did 3 years of specialized GI training. And in those 3 years, you do a lot of colonoscopies that are supervised. So yes, you haven't been practicing out there for 30 years on your own, but you have been trained to do this and you have done a lot of procedures and you've done at least 3 years of specialty training, for example, GI. And if it's another specialty where you're doing, say, a chest or like a lung biopsy, you've also been trained specifically for that. So you can talk about
answers
that.
With smoke and mirrors is the answer. No, it's true.
No, it's true.
Good. That's
it's
a good answer. Actually.
It's 100% true and you're not lying.
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell them you're fresh out of fellowship, but fellowship is there for a reason.
Yeah.
It's there to train you very experience. Well in these
towards,
things. That's why you do 3 years.
Most people are sort of cruising solo. There's always supervision because that's the definition of a fellowship. But a lot of times you're really a full functioning physician, who doesn't need supervision, but it's always there and available.
And you know, there's some pluses to having a new doctor. There's some pluses to having them. They are the most up to date with the newest techniques.
Mm-hmm.
They are the most up to date with sort of the newest guidelines. So there's certainly some positives to having a new doctor.
Yeah, totally. I got a part of it's the procedure too, I guess. You know, colonoscopies are probably really easy compared to doing a sacral colpopexy.
Whoa!
GYN,
whoa!
Right?
Whoa, I'm not even going to ask how you, I just want to leave that as a mystery to the listeners. Like
all the people are on Google right now looking up sacral colpopexy.
Joe's like, I just blacked out. What did I say?
Yeah.
He went into like that.
A trance. Anyways, all right.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Jennifer, for giving us that question. Please call more calls, more emails to tell us when we're wrong.
408-444-6623. I remember the number. After
strong
3 months.
Work, man. Strong work. All right. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the House of Pod. We are joined by our good friend, Erin LePage. She's a fantastic nurse. Both Lizzie and I have had the opportunity to work with her. She's here to give us some nursing perspective and also specifically maybe talk to us about being a traveling nurse. Joe, I think you have a question first, right?
Yes, I do. So what is the driving reasons a hospital would hire a traveling nurse versus maybe someone on their own? Is it a shortage issue with nurses or, and also with that, is my assumption correct that you would be in more of a temporary role with each hospital moving from one to the other?
Yeah, and I think probably like 10 years ago, it was more that there was a shortage of nurses and, you know, they just, now that there's more people in nursing than there was like 10, 15 years ago. And so that it would just be a concentrated place, like say the big cities where they need these nurses or even the small towns. One case, I went to Portland, Oregon, and the hospital had, the nurses had gone on strike. But they went on strike for an extended period of time. And by that time, those nurses needed to go get jobs at other hospitals. And so the one hospital where they had been striking at had no nurses. And some of the travel nurses had been there for a year. And so that was one place where I stayed a long time because they had a hard time bringing the nurses back after they quit to go.
Got it.
Because they were on strike and the strike lasted longer than what they could financially
afford,
be out of work for. So they went and got jobs at other hospitals. So then it just took a long time to get that pool of nurses back up. And so then that's when they use travelers. Sometimes they'll use travelers at holiday seasons, in the summertime, at Christmas time, when regular staff nurses are taking their vacation days.
That makes sense.
So you've done both traveling nursing and regular nursing, what we envision as regular nursing, like more stationary at one place. Do you feel like there, this is such an ignorant question, I'm sorry, I should probably already know this, but is there some weird interactions between traveling nurses and regular nurses? Like, do regular nurses kind of look at traveling nurses like these people are just coming in, they're going to leave, we're not even going to have an emotional connection to them, they're taking our jabs, that sort of thing?
Well, not only that, but then you also, as if that's your hospital and you're a staff nurse and a travel nurse comes in, sometimes you feel like you have to, it's like training a new nurse, like, where all the equipment is,
right,
how you do things. And
it's just a hassle.
Yeah, and then you know that nurse is going to leave in 3 to 6 months, so it's kind of like you don't want to get too invested.
Mm-hmm. But as far as like emotional stuff, like last week there was a lunch, I don't think you were there, for someone's birthday or retirement, and everyone's like, everyone go get lunch, go get lunch. And then they're like, no, not for the travelers. Like, it's just this weird thing where, like,
wow.
And also if the travelers are coming in to help with a strike, they're considered like scabs.
Scabs,
yeah.
Right?
And there is that, like, distaste for that, you know, where they're hurting their union, they're hurting their strength as a union, you know. So there are those a couple of different things where you definitely feel a little bit of a discrepancy. And again, the nature of a traveler is that they're new, so there's a little bit of maybe hazing involved for some of our senior nurses who don't want to spend the time, not real hazing, but like a little bit of a maybe an attitude here or there. But I do think there's subtle things, you know.
What advice would you give to yourself? Like, if you could go back to when you were first starting nursing school.
Clearly, it's
leave
Canada. Leave Canada, get the hell out.
Other than get out of Canada as soon as possible.
I think I would have traveled
more.
We
love Canadians.
I definitely would have traveled more. I would have been...
internationally, or...
Yeah, I mean, I also worked in Australia for a period of time, and I think that I would have just taken that to work, like, in other countries, and maybe done some more, like, more mission or more that kind of
so
work.
You definitely think doing the traveling nurse thing was a good idea, and you recommend that.
You know, it takes a certain person to be able to be a travel nurse, because you have to pick up, you have to let go of a lot of, like, your own
material stuff.
Well, not just material stuff, but just how you work as a person and how you adapt, because each place has its own way of doing things.
Yeah.
And so you can't hang on to, oh, this is how I trained to do it, and so this is the only way that it can be done.
Because so many different computer systems, different just like hierarchy kind of things.
And what
and
you're
structures.
Saying is, you're totally right. Every place has a different culture and the way they do their stuff. And something that both nurses, I think, and doctors are bad about is being very set in the ways that they were trained.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's a good thing, because it's good to have a structure and to know what you're doing and to do the same thing every time. But you go to a new place, it is important to say, what are they doing here that might be better? And that's hard for both nurses and doctors. That's something good, I think, about being a traveling nurse. You're right. I noticed from working with you in the past is that you were
flexible.
You're flexible. You're like, I haven't tried that before. Let's try that. Yeah. Let's see if that works.
Well, then.
And then you can give honest feedback about it after you've tried that.
So I did actually traveling medicine for about 6 months as a GI doctor, and I knew it was short term, but something I sort of realized that A, you have to like to travel to do that kind of stuff, which not everybody likes to do, and B, you have to, I think it's actually quite good for when you're very early in your career, like it sounds like that's how you started, or you're very late in your career and you're sort of trying to, you know, transition out and like take it easy and pick and choose the locations and jobs you want. So that's sort of my advice from doing it for a very short period of time.
You enjoyed your time as a traveler, but you in this at this point in your life, that's not something you'd be interested in doing again, is it?
I think if my husband's job was more where he could travel with me and we would just travel together, I would totally do that. But then at the same point, then you're more likely to get, like if I went back to the ER, I'd probably have to do night shift. I probably would have to do weekends. So I would do the holidays. And so you just have a little more stability and say in when you work, when you're a staff nurse at the hospital.
Right, right.
Sounds like a tough job being the travel nurse. Is there an advantage of or a reason why you would choose doing that versus working in one hospital?
You know, there's a lot of things like as I was a traveler, like if I acted a certain way or if I was harsh or I mean, you can just see, and sometimes it's working in the emergency, that environment leads you to be like sometimes a negative, harsh person because all the patients around you, I mean, you're being spit at, they're throwing their pee at you, they're calling you every name. And so
God, doctors can be so mean.
This is just the doctors, exactly. Right. So I think if you can learn from a situation and then the next place you go to, if you've been a jerk, then you can correct that and it doesn't go with you, like you leave it there.
That's you can sort of reinvent yourself. You can take what you learned from another place, go to a new place, use it there.
And then you get to see some of the country too. Like you can, if I had done it differently, I would have traveled more. Like I would have done, because I, in the beginning, just picked up and moved. Like I wasn't in a travel company. I just picked up and would move. I think had I to do it again, I would travel nurse more and then take my, like, work for 9 months and then take 3 months off and travel, like, Africa or do something like that.
Yeah.
I have a question as well. And we'll get to a voicemail in a second. But do you feel like the patients or staffers appreciate you or doctors? Because I feel like one experience that I know we've all had, sorry, Joe, everyone but Joe, is that, you know, you'll be late. You know, I have an appointment with a patient or my procedure is going late, and the patients will be so angry and so frustrated, as they should be, but all the wrath goes to like the nurses checking them in, and then I'll be like, hi, I'm Dr. Ross, and they'll be like, oh, hi, how are you? And they'll be so sweet all of a sudden. And then after we do a procedure, I'll get emails sometimes saying, thank you so much, a procedure went so well. And sometimes they'll say, thank the staff and the nurses and everyone, but I don't, and I get the email, and I don't know how you guys would hear that praise, you know, like, how do you feel appreciated?
I think because we're the first line, first person they see, and we see, you know, they're seeing the nurse not like 80% of the time, and then they see the doctor for 20% of the time. So it's easier to direct that anger at the nurse, and you just have to learn, like, and people have different coping mechanisms. So you just kind of have to filter through, and it's never about what it's about. And so if they're angry,
You're not internalizing that. Yeah. You're not taking it personally. You know they're stressed because they're there for a procedure or a surgery, or they're not feeling well. Obviously, they're sick.
Or the doctor's late and they're okay. It's correct to be frustrated. Mm-hmm. But you guys do, I think, get the brunt. And we come in and say, hey, we're going to do your procedure. And then we get to give them drugs. Like, we get like all the good stuff.
Yeah. And I think it's also like a lot of talking to these people. Like, if you know the procedure is going to be late, let them know. And I always say, like, you know, we're running late. Whoever before you didn't exactly fit in the hour time block that they were given, but we're going to take the time that we need for you, and we're going to take the time that we need for each patient, and not everybody fits into this time slot.
And this also, it works and rings true for clinical medicine, not procedural medicine or surgeries as well. It's the same sort of concept in a clinic. It's really the nursing and the MAs who are working the front line dealing with patients. And you guys, in general, do a great job of making us look good. So thank you for that.
Thank you. You should accept that on behalf of all nurses everywhere.
Now we have a voicemail.
From Donald.
Hello, House of Pod and the KLJ, Kaveh, Lizzie, and Joe. My name's Dopo, and I'm calling from San Francisco. First-time caller, long-time listener, huge fan of the show. I really enjoyed all the interviews and the personal opinions on many topics. My question is there a sense of hierarchy or status amongst doctors and fellow staff members? First off, such that doctors introduce themselves as Dr. Kaveh and Dr. Lizzie, but nurses or staff members typically don't introduce themselves as Nurse Nancy or Transporter Travis. And secondary, is there a hierarchy between doctors, gastroenterologists versus cardiologists versus anesthesiologists and so on? Thanks for taking my call. Dopo out.
Thanks for the call, Dopo. So essentially, Donald's asking, I think you could hear it. It actually, I think, came off pretty well. But is there a sense of hierarchy or status among doctors and fellow staffers? We say Dr. Kaveh, Dr. Lizzie, and you, I mean, honestly, I hear you introduce yourself. You'll say, hi, I'm Erin. I'm the nurse that you'll be working with. So I don't know if that makes a big distinction as far as sort of structure and hierarchy and, you know, status. It's a good question.
I mean, I guess there is, but I kind of personally think there should be. I mean, you've gone to school for longer, you've put the sweat equity into earning that name, and I think that it should be called me. I actually have a problem once you get to know the physicians on like a personal level. Like, I will rarely call you Dr. Ross. I will rarely call you Lizzie at work.
Right.
Like, it's a comfort level. Even when I worked in the ER and you work closely to those doctors, I always address them in the work setting as doctor.
And I think that's actually appropriate, because even though if you were to refer to her here in this setting as, you know, Dr. Ross and not Lizzie, that would be weird to us. But I do think in the work setting, like when the patient is there, mm-hmm. it's for the patient's well-being, mm-hmm. really. They want to hear that name. I mean, if you're on an airplane and like the stewardess is referring to the captain as like, Tom, hey, Tom, when are we leaving? It doesn't have the same like ring to it as Captain Phillips or whatever. When are we taking off? It makes a difference, I think.
Right. I often tell, when I first started, I haven't done it in a while, I tell nurses and staffers, call me Lizzie. But I think it is hard to remember when a patient's in the room, I don't want to be called Lizzie, because I don't want them to call me Lizzie, because I don't know, because I did train and I did spend mm-hmm. a lot of time and money. And I don't, you know, I'm also already being a young woman. I feel like I have to sort of establish myself a little bit more. And I do think that sometimes wearing a white coat and calling me doctor makes me feel like they're respecting me more. And I don't feel that way, though, with nurses.
I'm still not getting out of my chair for you.
I just don't feel that way with nurses. Like, I would love for nurses to call me Lizzie, but I agree, it's hard to sort of look around you and remember, oh, there's a patient here, I shouldn't call her Lizzie. You know what I mean? It's just, I think it is hard to switch that easily, that quickly. So I don't feel the hierarchy. And I do think it depends on where you work. Like, if you work at an institution where, like, it's not like the doctors pay the nurses their mm-hmm. salary in at where we work, you know? So I think that if you're in an office where the doctors are paying the nurses' salary and the MA, the medical assistants' salaries, I do think that that's sets a different tone than from where we work, where we're totally two different structures.
Well, I, you know, for me, I see it all from what I think the patient would want. Like, I think the patient wants to know that there is a hierarchy to some degree. I think the patient, I mean, we want to get along with our colleagues, and we consider our friends, our nurses, to be our equals for sure. But at the same time, there is sort of a hierarchy as to who's giving sort of the orders for what happens. And I think patients want that. I think that, I mean, if I were a patient to go in, I want to know that there's someone that's accountable at the end of the day.
That's the difference. So the word hierarchy, I think, is a struggle for me, because it just means a status mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. merit, without earning
sure.
it. But what hierarchy, I think what we're all saying, it means accountability and responsibility.
Yeah. Right.
And if something goes wrong in that room, you know, it is. I do feel
right.
like it's my responsibility yeah. being mm-hmm. the doctor. So for that, that is, you know, it's like a military concept, just hierarchy, just for the sake of it. But I do think that if it translates into responsibility, that might be a good thing, you know?
The second part of the question
yeah.
I think is really good. You know, is there a hierarchy amongst doctors? And that's a big topic. And I think we've touched on it a little bit. I'm sure we're going to touch on it a lot more. But yes, there sort of is. There shouldn't be.
Yeah,
there shouldn't be. Every doctor should be considered, you know, equal, you know. But certainly, I think certain doctors in certain fields feel that they are above right. other mm-hmm. doctors.
But to what Aaron said is if a doctor gets more respect or higher up on the food chain because there's more training, then you would think that somebody who's done cardiology, gastroenterology is higher up than a family practice doctor because we did an extra 3 years. We sure. spent the time, but we don't necessarily think that. I think I'm the expert and the best in GI. And, you know, cardiology versus anesthesiology were the other ones. And, you know, I don't know that I think that I'm better or they think they're better. I just think it's like we have these stereotypes. You know, the ER doc will assess someone really quickly and get them out of the ER so that they can go to the ICU or the floor or whatever. The cardiologist, you know, they just, you know, maybe they make more money typically. So you might have a stereotype about that. And it becomes this game of sort of us versus them. And I think it's sort of good for your mindset to be like, we're in this together. But there definitely is a line where you can cross where like, oh, those ER docs are just idiots. They just yeah. kicked them out. You know, there's a line that you can cross.
It's a lot like what I imagine the whole like Army, Navy yeah. sort of competition is like in terms of medicine. Like medicine doctors will talk about surgeons like yeah. the surgeons don't care or aren't very smart, and surgeons will talk about doctors like medicine doctors like, you know, they just weren't good enough to get into surgery or something like that. There's always, everyone has some sort of stereotype about every other group just to make doctors feel better about themselves.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, there are people who do more training for certain jobs. In my mind, that just makes them experts in that field.
Right.
And that's really where the line should be drawn.
But we should go through every field and talk about the, like, at orthopedic surgeons or dumb jocks.
What the stereotypes you mean are?
Yeah, yeah. It's just sort of fun.
I will say this. Here's one thing I have noticed, though. The doctors that tend to be the coolest people, the people that you actually would want to hang out with and get a beer, they tend to be the people with the least, like, years put into their training. Wow. In my sort of, like, experience, the people who do like the family practice stuff, they do like the least amount of years of training, they like go out, they practice, they're the most down to earth. The people who spend the most time in the academic setting, going to that next level, reaching these academic achievements, I think they start to buy into a little bit of this concept of how great they are. And I think that maybe they stop working on themselves a little bit, you know, or whatever it is, they tend to get a little bit, in my sort of experience, a little bit harder to just hang out with. Now, some of my best friends are advanced, you know, endoscopists, or yeah. they're advanced surgeons, or they've done some sort of super subspecialty of like some nephrology or something. But I would say just in general, I feel that's the case.
Well, the coolest stereotype, the ones with the coolest stereotype is ER docs and like anesthesiologists, because they're sort of like shift workers and you think about them like just leaving and then going and surfing, you know, all the cool stuff. That's definitely like they get that one.
But to go back to the question, there probably is, but in everyone's mind, there's probably a hierarchy, but in every specialty's mind, they're probably on top of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Really, really interesting to hear this because I, from a patient's point of view, I don't think the patient looks at one doctor versus another being higher or lower. It's just the doctor that's going to be right. ultimately helping them. Doesn't matter if it's ER or a specialist. That's the doctor that you're going to be focusing on. So, hearing all these levels of things going on in that world is really a little surprising, but I can understand because we're all human.
It is like this. We talked about how the hospital is this weird sort of world in of itself, and in that world there's all these different sort of like levels, and there's all these, it's like a maze, like it's like a labyrinth, and then it makes a bunch of sense when you're in the hospital. But if you ever stop and take a look back and you're just like, well, these people are all doctors, it's just they think they're something, but it's just the hospital setting, then you kind of realize there really isn't much of a difference. There isn't much more to it than that.
Right. Dr. Cool doesn't mean that much.
Right.
Thank you, Donald. It's a wonderful question, and I think it's insightful. So thanks for calling him.
All right. Well, that's probably all the time we have for this show. It's been awesome to have you on, Aaron. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing the maple leaf cookies.
That's right.
All the way from Canada. Appreciate that.
I had to get that open box out of my house.
Yeah, we're probably going to finish that before we leave here today.
Yeah,
I understand. Yeah. We'll help you with your diet.
Thank
you for coming.
Thanks again. We really
thanks. It was fun.
We have to have you back on some point. Get some nursing. Get a male nurse maybe on too as well.
Donald, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe Donald or Jeff mm-hmm. or some of these other people we've worked with in the past. If you have questions, remember email us, HOP hopequestions@gmail.com. That's HOP questions with an S. If you want to call and leave a voicemail, it is 408-444-6623. Thank you to Nadeem Abu Baker for helping us produce this thing. Thanks for everyone for the emails and the words of encouragement. We appreciate it, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.